Good morning and welcome to the program, 1180 WFYL's We the People, the Constitution Matters. Mike Levins here, and joining me is Gary Porter, who's Executive Director of the Constitution Leadership Initiative. We also have along with us Phil Duffy, who is a teacher on the Constitution at the Osher Lifelong Learning Institute, and Pastor David Whitney, all constitutional experts. And it's wonderful, once again, we're doing another look into the founders' worldview, specifically education. We've done this last week, now we're continuing because it's so important, and it was so important to the founders. But, Gary, we have these essays that you put out each week, and this is a lot of our reference material for the program. For our listeners, why don't you explain a little bit about these essays and how much you put into them, what they're all about?
Well, they started out as a project writing for our local newspaper, a weekly essay, and it started out a long time ago with a little 400-word essay, and I quickly realized that I couldn't say anything in 400 words. Well, I could, but I couldn't say enough.
And 400 words is like four paragraphs, right?
Well, yeah, it wasn't a lot, and so there were some points that you just really couldn't deal with in that space, so I quickly expanded it, and I've been producing them now for a couple of years. So, but here's the point. I want to make sure that your listeners know that as we're discussing these essays on the air, we may or may not cover the pertinent points of, or all the pertinent points of them. So if your listeners want to subscribe to my writing, then they can do that. Just send me an email at gary@constitutionleadership.org. And I'll be glad to put them on my mailing list. The essay we discussed Friday morning comes out every Thursday. And so we, you know, we'll discuss what we can of it in the hour we have available. And then on Friday, I also sent out another essay we don't discuss on the air, but it's called The Constitution's Week in Review. And in that one, I take a look at events that have hit the headlines that week that have a constitutional connection. And I give my view of the constitutionality or the importance of that to be understood by the American people. And so your readers might be interested in seeing the full extent of what the essays cover rather than just the highlights that we're able to discuss in our Friday morning show. So it's gary@constitutionleadership.org.
And Gary, you're very much a constitutional expert. If you read the essays, they are very much a journey into thought as the founders would have seen it on the Constitution regarding different issues. So I highly recommend them. They're very, very educational and very, very enlightening. Is very well put together as well. So you could email Gary if you would like to get these essays. It's gary@constitutionleadership.org, gary@constitutionleadership.org. Well, Gary, why don't you start us off this morning? We're continuing our discussion on the founders' worldview in education.
Yeah, this was so complex a topic that I had to split it across what will be three essays now because it was just too much to take on and do justice to in a single effort. So,
and you do quite some research into this as well.
Well, I've got a stack of books sitting here in my office that will go back down on the shelves after we finish part three, but they've been very helpful. Yeah, there's a lot to this, and fortunately, there are a couple books that have been very helpful to me. Larry Schweikert put out a book saying called What Would the Founders Say? And in it, he deals with several questions that he kind of hypothetically poses to this group of founders that he's assembled, and he discusses, as I'm doing, what their view of that subject would have included. That's been real helpful because there is a section in there on education. So that and a couple other books have been most helpful in putting this series together. So today, or last week, we talked about the American educational system itself what was the system in place that produced men like James Madison and Thomas Jefferson and Benjamin Franklin and George Washington? What kind of an educational system did they come up through that produced this, well, Jefferson calls them a an assembly of demigods, as he references the men, the 55 men who were at the Constitutional Convention, because they have given us, they gave us a Constitution that has really survived the years, has survived the test of time. The longest running Constitution we have in recorded history, and that says a lot. So the men who put that together certainly deserve some scrutiny in terms of what educational system produced that intelligence, that capability to reason and to persuade and to look at history and gather the lessons of it. So last week we looked at that educational system, and we saw that it was primarily focused on the home. The parents had the primary responsibility, as they read in the Bible, that was their responsibility, and they took that responsibility seriously. And so they educated their children and made sure that they had the skills and the tools to operate productively in society. And today we're going to look at, once these gentlemen reached the age and the positions where they could influence education in the United States, what did they do with that power, that ability? Did they make any significant changes to the educational system that had produced them, that they had come up through? That's where we are today.
And, you know, David, it's very telling to me that our founders' education, and it seems that whenever we talk about any topic regarding the founders, it all goes back to Scripture somehow. It all ties into the Bible. That's very telling to me.
Yes, it's interesting to see that the Bible really, in their understanding, was the foundation of all education. You know, yes, you're going to learn mathematics and science and so on, but those things are founded on a biblical worldview of everything. And that's an idea that many people today say, what? That has nothing to do with education at all. In fact, we don't let the Bible into our government-run schools because that's the opposite of education. That's the idea that's prevalent today. It's the opposite of our founders, because
that
our
it's
founders
indoctrination or anything like that. Yeah,
yeah. If you don't have a biblical view of God's rule of the universe and God's creation of the universe, then you don't even have a place to start from. How do you know what's right and what's wrong? Well, is it a 50% vote? You know, 51% of the people vote, they get to determine what's right or what's wrong. Or is it nine black robe lawyers that, when they vote, five out of four of those determine what's right and wrong? You have moral anarchy if you don't have God's law at the foundation of a person's education.
And the primary purpose of that education, and this is, Gary, this is according to your research here, that the primary purpose was really to understand Scripture. Phil, you know, you're a teacher on the Constitution as well. Does that sound right?
Oh, absolutely. There's no question about the relationship there. None whatsoever.
So we could establish a very strong connection right there with anything we talk about with the founders, we're going to find that in any work that they did. We're going to find that in the Constitution, in the Declaration of Independence. Of course, those things secure our rights as Americans. Gary, why don't you continue? And I'm sure there's more information we could dig into.
Well, having grown up through a educational system where the Bible was preeminent, where it was the primary textbook and often taught by ministers, Reverend Maury, Reverend Robertson, Reverend Witherspoon, these were the men that taught the founders. It is helpful to note that when these men reached adulthood and were able to influence public policy, they still held to that same view, that the Bible was important to be central to the educational process. Benjamin Rush said, he signed the Declaration of Independence, and he says the Bible should be read in our schools in preference to all other books, from its containing the greatest portion of that kind of knowledge which is calculated to produce private and public temporal happiness. So if you want to be happy, then read the Bible.
Then read the Bible,
want,
yeah.
And if you want your kids to be happy, then teach them the Bible. That's the thrust there. Noah Webster, who produced our first great dictionary, education is useless without the Bible. So, it's comforting to know that these men still held to these views when they reached adulthood and maturity. It wasn't just some passing fad as they came up through the educational process.
Now, practically as well, the Bible was a prevalent printed book, I would go out on a limb there to say, at the time, so that it was basically a textbook. It was a very readily available textbook for learning grammar, and that's what I'm supposing here, and I believe that is correct, and correct me if I'm wrong.
No, you're quite correct. It was certainly focused on reading, and the purpose for learning to read itself was to read the Bible so that you could understand God's Word and his plan for mankind. But, you know, the Bible has something to say about everything. You can find science lessons in the Bible. You can find mathematics lessons in the Bible. It's not just a book of morality. There's economic lessons in there. There are social lessons. There's all sorts of things to be gleaned from the Bible if you're willing to look for them.
And it really touches every area of life. And that touched the founders' lives as well. And the second purpose of education that you put forward as well, Gary, in this essay, is not just, first is to understand the Bible, but that what ties directly into that is shaping character.
Right, and that is found most directly by looking at Webster's definition of what constitutes education. In Webster's view, education was more than just teaching kids how to the skills that they will need to be productive citizens. It was, in fact, shaping their character to be good citizens, good Christians, good people. The moral component of education was as important, if not more so, than the knowledge component of it.
Phil, do you think we're missing that mark as far as teaching character in our education system today, especially since you teach at a outreach, and that's more of a Christian term, but basically an outreach of a local collegiate institution? Would you say that the education system is missing the mark with the students that come in the Usher Lifelong Learning Institute?
Well, I can't say that in the brief encounter that I have with these students that I'm in a position to judge that. I can look at the experiences that I've had in homeschool teaching, which I also do, and you see a marked difference, it seems to me, between those students who come up through, and these are religious-based homeschool experiences, just a remarkable difference between these students and those students who come through the government schools. And that's not to say that, all students who go through the latter have been tainted by the system and so forth, because we always have to realize that we're individuals and not groups or abstractions.
And I'm not suggesting that necessarily that there are less than stellar citizens coming out as far as character. But I am suggesting, because sometimes there are just things that go unaddressed in people's lives, and that could really cause problems for them. And sometimes it's quite plain and evident that you could see that. And if in the education system we neglect to address any issues of character, the issues in their lives, which sometimes can be plain, whether it's, let's say, simple things, maybe an anger problem, or maybe something was wrong at home. And teachers talk about that kind of thing all the time. My fiance is a teacher. She talks about sometimes she can know which students come from a broken home. She's in elementary school. But those things will go unaddressed and will ultimately not only work against the student, but it's going to work against the nation. Though that's what I'm suggesting when I put that forward.
Well, you can look at the Pearce test results and compare the results of students who are being homeschooled, students who are being taught in Christian schools, and students who are being taught in public schools. And you can derive some conclusions from that. Certainly the students in public school settings are not graduating with a biblical worldview. They are graduating that process after 12 years with a completely secular worldview, a socialistic worldview. And that should come as no surprise once you have taken the Bible and prayer out of the schools, as we did in 1962 and 63. There's really no place in the curriculum to now instill the principles of the Bible, such as self-government, which is so critically important. In a Christian school setting, you can still do that. In a homeschool setting, of course, you can still do that. You can instill the importance of self-government. But in a public school setting, you can't do that. And they don't. And so you see the results in the way the students perform on the Pearce test.
Phil, your comment.
Well, I'd like to point to the fact that the Bible plays a role. If you go back to the founding generation, Bible plays a role, a unifying role, in what really comes down to a pluralistic, non-coercive system. And the system really starts at the mother's knee, if you will. The father is involved in education. You find many of the founding generation being tutored by others, including clergy. And then they go off to institutions of higher learning, all of which have affiliations with some religious community. And what's the unifying part of all of this? If you have, you know, all of these different parts involved in the educational system, how is all of that unified? Well, the Bible was the unifying mechanism for all of that. I mean, there was an understanding that as a student went through various steps in that educational system, that they had been adequately prepared, and everybody knew what that preparation was. It was a biblical preparation.
David, Pastor David, I would like to get your take on, because you, I'm sure, you may be involved. You've probably, as a pastor, I'm sure that you probably have parents that, if you do not know, that may even be in your congregation, who choose to homeschool or send their children to a private school. Your comment on this discussion.
Well, thank you, Michael, because most of the congregation, because I've been preaching this for years, my message is basically take your children out of Pharaoh's schools. Pharaoh is going to indoctrinate your children in a non-Christian belief system, an anti-biblical belief system that's going to lead them away from the Christian faith. So bring your children out. Let's have an exodus out of the public system. And that has been a successful message. The vast majority of our congregation are either homeschooling or in Christian private school. And we have a ministry that helps families begin to homeschool, because I know a lot of folks are a little leery about that.
And it's hard to do.
My wife actually teaches. Yeah, and my wife teaches in a Christian school, and it's interesting to see, even in the Christian school, she could tell those families that are not really coming from a Christian background, don't have their kids in church, are not reading the Bible at home. So what the school is doing is very influential, but the parents, in one sense, in those situations, are not supporting what the school is doing. And she could tell a difference between the students whose family life, church life, centered on the Bible, as well as what they're receiving in a Christian education.
Now, notice what you said when you were talking about public school indoctrination. So they're not necessarily having much room for an open, because I remember in public school it was better when I was in public school than it would seem to be now. But it is really leaning on the side of indoctrination, where
yes,
you're not encouraged necessarily if you have one worldview or another. I remember in my economics class, I was the only one who, and I believe this, I don't believe I was indoctrinated in any way to have more of a conservative view of economics, but my whole class was of the opposite opinion and my teacher, and I would constantly, not ridiculed in a mean way, but I was the only one, I was part of the few that believed that, and I would always be the topic of discussion because of that. It was very, very much a pressuring situation.
And well, consider this, Mike. Lincoln said it this way. He said that the philosophy of the philosophy in the schoolroom in one generation will be the philosophy of government in the next generation. And if that is a true statement, then we're in trouble, because the philosophy in our public schools today is socialism. There's no way other way to characterize it, and that means that when those students reach maturity and positions of responsibility, then that will be the philosophy in our government. It will no longer be economic capitalism or it won't be a system that recognizes the principles found in the Bible. It will be a system of government that is entirely socialistic.
Pastor Dave, your comment.
What we need to remember is that no form of education is neutral. You're going to come from some worldview. Now, what we've been sold is the lie that somehow we can be objective and nobody offer their worldview in educating anyone on subject matters. But that's absolutely impossible. If relativism was a worldview that was true, and it's not, we know it's not true, but if it was true, then how can mathematics be true? Why would 2 plus 2 equal 4 today and equal 4 tomorrow? It might equal 6 or 7, or the relativist says there is no absolute truth, so therefore 2 plus 2 may equal 4, but not today, tomorrow, or the next day. So your worldview shapes every single area of education, and if you don't have the Bible for the foundation that there is a creator God, that he's the one that created the universe, and the laws of the universe, mathematics, chemistry, and the moral laws, thou shalt not kill, if his law isn't what you're studying, then the question is, what are you studying? The opinion of one man versus the opinion of another man.
And not to mention that the view of the relativist that there is no absolute truth not only defies logic, but it also illustrates, how can I be nice about this? It also illustrates a lack of understanding of logical precepts, you know, that there you have to have definitions and then you compare things of those definitions and they stand on their own. We've got to head to a break, but when we return, we're going to continue the conversation on education. You could call in, by the way, and if you have a question about the Constitution or about the history as the founders lived it, and you have a question that you would like to put forward to Gary, Phil, or David, you could call in at 610-539-TALK. That's 610-539-TALK. I'm Michael Levins. We will continue the conversation on the other side of this break, continuing looking at the purposes of education for the founders in their day and why religion, the Bible, was at the core of it all.
Radio. I'm Chris Foster. The search for two escaped killers in upstate New York remains focused on the area around the prison. Fox's Anna Koyman in West Plattsburgh on a suspected accomplice who supervised the prison tailor shop.
Joyce Mitchell reportedly now admits she smuggled Matt and Sweat the power tools they used to tunnel out. Now, she was believed to have fallen for Richard Matt, but now it's also revealed she may have also had a relationship with David Sweat.
The men have been missing since Saturday. The head of Spokane, Washington's NAACP chapter has been falsely claiming she's black for years, according to Rachel Dolezal's white parents, Larry and Ruth Ann.
She's Caucasian by birth.
She wants to recreate reality. She wants to just invent it herself.
Their daughter tells the Spokane Spokesman Review newspaper there are a lot of complexities. We're all from the African continent. Fox News, we report. You decide.
Hey, Grandma, can you help me with my Common Core lesson on the Constitution? But the only part we're reading in 8th grade is the preamble and the First Amendment. I wonder when we'll get to study the rest of it. Didn't you say our founding fathers were wise patriots and wrote the Constitution and the Bill of Rights to protect our freedom? This Common Core book we're reading says our founding fathers were racist and they didn't think women or blacks should ever be allowed to vote. She says, we the people. Didn't really mean you and me, but some rich white guys. That just makes me feel terrible about our country. We need to change things.
Oh, honey, that's not true at all. Our country is the greatest country the world has ever seen, and our founding fathers worked hard to be fair to everyone. I'm going to call our school board and our state board of education and ask why they allow Common Core and this book in your school.
Call your representatives now and ask them to stop Common Core and restore local control. Pennsylvanians Against Common Core brought you this message. Go to nopacommoncore.com or call 484-678-2236.
ShopRite of Hatfield is American-owned, locally operated grocer. We support veterans and seniors by giving 5% discounts. Just bring in your ID. Download the ShopRite mobile app to enjoy weekly savings, coupons, recipes, and so much more. ShopRite of Hatfield, 170 40-foot road, open 7 days a week, 7 a.m. to 11 p.m.
ShopRite, we're all about food, savings, and you.
Hi, I'm Hans Tenbaum with Valley Forge PC Repair. I offer affordable and expert computer repair services. Deal with a locally owned business who cares more about their clients' needs. The services provided include virus removal, repair, cleanups, tune-ups, tutoring, consulting, and other computer services. Most services can be done at a flat rate. Senior citizens mentioned WFIL receive a 10% discount. Call me at 610-462-3210 for more information.
Good morning and welcome to The Constitution Matters, We the People, here on 1180 WFYL, working for your liberty. If you have a question about the Constitution or the history of the Constitution, you can call in at 610-539-TALK, 610-539-8255. You can pose that question to Gary, Phil, or you could also pose that question to Pastor David, all experts on the Constitution joining us this morning. Now, Phil, there is an exception. We've been talking about how education is biblically based for the founders. And we're talking also about how education was looked at as a way to develop character, and it was on an individual basis. Tell us about, there is one historical exception.
Well, there's one exception that I've been able to find, and I think that this is interesting in the sense that we've often heard that the exception proves the rule. If nothing else, it proves that the founding generation had considered the idea of more governmental involvement and a different view of education. Here's Benjamin Rush on education. Now, he's the signer of the Declaration of Independence. Everything we run across concerning Benjamin Rush is positive, but he says, let our pupil be taught that he does not belong to himself, but that he is public property. Let him be taught to love his family, but let him be taught at the same time that he must forsake and even forget them when the welfare of his country requires it.
Apparently the said pupil is joining the military.
Yes. Now, this is a troubling view of education, even when, you know, you allow for context. And it certainly conflicts with Locke's self-ownership concept as expressed in his two treatises on government. We are not public property. Now, that idea of being public property, I think, first emerges with Plato and his Republic. But we're not public property. That was Locke's point. And Locke was not arguing for a self-centered, me-first worldview, by the way. Indeed, in his first treatise on government, he specifically includes the duty of charity towards those who have no other means of subsistence. But Locke would have found Rush's view that pupils for public property appalling. So I think the significance of this is that the discussion had already occurred, and I'm sure others today would be able to identify early attempts to bring the government into education, which failed miserably because there was a very strong consensus against the idea of indoctrinating students.
Gary, your comment on Mr. Rush.
Well, that's not
too Rush
surprising.
Limbaugh.
Right. That's not too surprising. Benjamin Rush was an independent thinker. When you get into his writings, you find some startling revelations. For instance, as we're going to find out in a couple weeks when we look at the founder's social views, Benjamin Rush was dead set against capital punishment. He said, how can you put someone to death when we are Christians and the Christian religion would have us turn the other cheek? And so that was a very, very strange view to the founding generation. I think most of them would have accepted the idea of capital punishment. It was a common occurrence in the military. If you were caught as a spy, if you abandoned your post, the penalty was capital punishment. Capital punishment was a penalty in a lot of cases. It was a standard way of administering justice. Even Thomas Jefferson endorsed capital punishment for certain crimes. But Benjamin Rush definitely did not. And so he took his view directly out of the Bible, and he came to this opposite conclusion. So he's definitely an independent thinker. And I'm not surprised to see him coming up with something that was unique to Benjamin Rush.
Oh, no, absolutely not. And that is something characteristic of all the founders, and Benjamin Rush is the exception. But there's something else. There's another link that you wanted to make to education that I think is important for our listeners to hear, Gary.
Well, yes. We find them all seeing the importance of the Bible to the educational process. But in the founding generation, we begin to see them talking and writing about how important education is to the continuance of liberty. Many of them made statements to that effect. And John Adams probably put it most bluntly when he said, liberty cannot be preserved without general knowledge among the people. And here's Benjamin Rush again. The only foundation for a useful education in a republic is to be laid in religion. Without this, there can be no virtue, and without virtue, there can be no liberty. And liberty is the object and life of all republican governments. So they saw a link, and I think it's kind of unique. I don't find anyone else in other periods of history talking about how essential education is to the success of liberty, the preservation of liberty, than this founding generation did.
Well, the third purpose of education, and you actually link, and these are the purposes you're laying out in your essay, but you link this, though, to Webster, Noah Webster, that the third purpose is, quote, for usefulness in their future stations. Quote, to every citizen, the information he needs for the transaction of his own business, to enable him to calculate for himself and to express and preserve his ideas, his contracts, and accounts in writing. And that's from Noah Webster, that is the third purpose of education, which is, again, going to be inextricably linked to a citizen in our great nation.
And that's why it is of such concern to see our educational standards continue to decline in this country. We'll be talking about that next week. We'll look at how our present educational system lines up with the views of the founders as we've been discerning them over the last couple weeks. And so next week should be a pretty exciting discussion. But if the preservation of liberty is so inextricably linked to a well-educated public, and our public school system is not producing that right now, and in fact getting worse at producing that as statistics continue to show, then we have a real reason to be concerned. And we should be concerned about how well liberty and freedom can be preserved in such an environment.
Now, there is an example of the view that religion and morality, character formation, essentially, is necessary for a good government and is necessary for the preservation of our nation. And that's the Northwest Ordinance of 1787. And it's a document that would govern the vast territory ceded by Virginia to the Confederation. And the quote is, "Religion, morality, and knowledge being necessary to good government, schools and the means of education shall forever be encouraged." Pastor David, I'd like your comment on that.
Well, it's interesting they say encouraged, because encouragement does not mean you're going to actually fund it. You're not going to pour money into it, but you're going to create the environment where it can flourish. And indeed, they're recognizing the point that we were just making in the previous statement, that without a true Christian biblical worldview being trained and cultivated in the citizens, you're not going to be able to preserve a Republican form of government. Republican, that is, small r, the principles of our founders. So this experiment in liberty that they began here in these United States would only survive if they could train the next generation in those same biblical principles of law and government, the principle of what liberty consists of, as well as the moral character that is needed in each citizen. In our system, we are not dependent upon police to be sure that everybody's obeying the law. We are dependent on people who are self-governed. That is, they know what God's law is. They seek to obey God's law in their own lives. They seek to seek that their family obeys God's law. Their churches do. So these other structures, other than the civil government itself, are absolutely essential to preserve liberty, or else you're going to devolve into anarchy, kind of like the riots we saw in Baltimore several weeks ago.
Now,
if the children aren't cultivated with a biblical understanding and the moral character to obey God's law themselves, you cannot hire enough police to be sure that people are safe in their lives and their liberty and their property.
Now, a lot of people dismiss the Northwest Ordinance. They say it's overtly religious in its prescription. They point out that it is no longer in effect. Over the span of 55 years, the territory it once governed gradually became Ohio, Indiana, Illinois, Michigan, and Wisconsin. So that's one argument people use for that particular citation, where we see that religion is something that even worked its way into governing documents.
Well, here's an important point, though. Yes, the Northwest Ordinance is no longer in effect over the Northwest Ordinance, but it is still part of our organic law of the United States. Congress had the foresight to make four documents constitute our organic law. One of those documents is the Constitution, okay? One of those documents is the Declaration of Independence. One is the Articles of Confederation, and the final one is the Northwest Ordinance of 1787. So even though it is no longer in effect as a governing document over any territory, it is still part of organic law. And so it can't be so easily dismissed as no longer applicable to our nation. Organic law is the fundamental law of a nation, whether it's written or unwritten. It is the system of law or system of principles which defines and establishes the organization of its government. So the Northwest Ordinance is still very important, and what it says has meaning for us today.
And it reflects the view of our founders, and this is so important, that if you want to understand the mind of our founders and how our system of government works and what it will take to succeed from generation to generation, the Northwest Ordinance is extremely important in giving us their perspective on that.
Absolutely, and that we noticed too that, and you mentioned a few very important documents there, Gary. Now, our founders understood, and this is a biblical worldview in and of itself, and Phil, I want to go to you, that I'm going to read a quote by Alexander Hamilton. "A fondness for power is implanted in most men, and it is natural to abuse it when acquired." Here's one from James Madison. "The essence of government is power, and power, lodged as it must be in human hands, will ever be liable to abuse." they understood that men are fallen and that they usually gravitate towards evil. Now, this in and of itself is a Christian worldview, is it not, Phil?
Yes, and you know, I've got a quote here by Jefferson that I think is very applicable to this idea, because Jefferson was commenting about a bill that would place control over education in the hands of state officials, and he deals with this issue of power and you know, how to manage it. And he says, if it is believed that these elementary schools will be better managed by the governor and council, the commissioners of the literary fund or any other general authority of government, than by the parents within each ward, it is a belief against all experience. Try the principle one step further and amend the bill so as to commit to the governor and council all our farms, our mills, and our merchant stores. No, my friend, the way to have good and safe government is not to trust it all to one, but to divide it among the many, distributing to everyone exactly the functions he is competent to. In other words, the idea of distribution of power is very, very much built into our foundation as a nation. It was recognized that you did not want to concentrate power. And particularly, Jefferson said, look, you concentrate power in education within the government, and you are creating a nightmare.
No, most certainly. And we see that echoed very plainly in the founder's worldview. Gary, your comment.
Well, I'm glad Phil brought that up. That's a great quote from Jefferson, and it's no surprise to find him thinking like that. He understood the danger of concentrated power. So when you let the federal government come down and dictate both curriculum choices as well as funnel money into this system, the public education system today, in a coercive way. That is, they say, we're going to give you money as long as you adopt Common Core and other standards. Then as Jefferson would clearly propose, we're going to have problems. We need to keep education as local as possible. And as local as possible, to the founders, meant the parents. The parents were as local as you could get, and the parents had the ultimate responsibility and the ultimate say in what their children were exposed to in the educational process.
Now, another part of education for the founders was process. Now, we saw how when we were talking about primary education, that it is first and foremost the responsibility of the parents, and that is even a biblical mandate. Parents who are unable or unwilling to carry that out, the community and or the government stepped in, and literacy was very much an imperative that economic obstacles wouldn't be allowed to interfere with the child becoming educated. And this is all talking about the founder's time, Gary.
Well, absolutely. We see it first in New England, where the education was actually imperative. It was. It goes back to what we call the old deluder Satan law, where children had to be educated so that they could learn to love God and not be susceptible to the wiles of Satan. So even if parents were unable or not even present, I mean, if we had orphans, we had parentless children, the community had the responsibility of making sure that those children were educated, because it was important to the community that those children not be susceptible to the subterfuge of Satan. So the community had this responsibility, and the community used this responsibility when necessary. When the parents were unwilling or unable to discharge their responsibilities as the primary guidance for education.
Now, I'm going to read a quote from Benjamin Rush. The blessings of knowledge can be extended to the poor, and laboring part of the community only by the means of free schools without religion. I believe that learning does real mischief to the morals and principles of mankind. Pastor David, your comment on that.
Well, Benjamin Rush is exactly right. And what we need to remember is that anyone that wanted an education in their day could receive that education because there were Christians who contributed to these free schools that he's referring to. That is, they were free not in that they didn't cost something, but people donated to them. Christians, often churches, were those that organized those schools so that the poor were seen as a ministry that the church could reach to. In fact, we think of Sunday school as part of the structure of the church these days and so on, but actually Sunday school was started in England in an attempt to reach children who had to work in the factories 6 days a week. And these children were obviously not receiving an education. They learned how to do a function in the factory, and that was their whole life. But the Christians had a desire that they should learn to read so they could read the Bible. So they would invite these children to come to Sunday school where they learn to read and learn to read the Bible. One of the commandments Christ has given to us is to go make disciples, and making a disciple, it involves teaching them how to read and then teaching them to read the Bible. And so if we understand what the founders had in their structure of society at that point, Christians who saw it as their duty to educate those children whose parents did not have the money to do so. And these free schools were very successful. They produced a well-educated citizenry, even though the parents were not able to fund it. And that could happen today. My wife is involved in teaching at a Christian school where they build a scholarship fund of people donating money to the school in order that children who cannot afford either the full tuition or part of the tuition are going to have funding available so that they can get a Christian education, even though their parents really can't afford the full price. It could happen today. In fact, if people were relieved of the tax burden, the huge tax burden of supporting the public government-run education system, a far better system could emerge that would actually educate better and teach morals and biblical principles to children whose parents are not able to afford it.
And oftentimes we see that the government steps in where the church and society may have stepped out, meaning charity, meaning actually providing education to one another, more of a sense of community, which is a biblical value, which is a biblical bit coming out of a biblical worldview, where the government steps in to fill that void. But we know how that usually results, and the end is not necessarily a good one.
And in the history of our country, it's actually not that the private and Christian organizations stepped out and there was a void that the civil government came in to fill. No, it was the other way around. They were filling, and we had an excellent education system, higher rate of literacy than any other country in the world, and a far higher rate of literacy than today. It wasn't that there was a void. The government came in and invaded what was a successful, privately run education enterprise all over our country and forced the children out of the private system that was working well, forced them out of that by compulsory education laws into the government-run schools against the wishes of most of the parents involved in those decisions.
Now, how that exactly played out is a discussion for another day, because that would be an interesting case study historically. But, you know, the founders saw no reason to change that structure of American education. If we look at some different quotes, okay, some of the founders, which I'm sure, Gary, you could probably rattle them off. We could see plainly that they saw no problem with the education system as it stood in their day.
No, they wanted to continue it. It worked for them, and they struggled with how best to finance these free schools, as Benjamin Rush described them. But and Thomas Jefferson, in fact, came up with a plan for education for Virginia that really wasn't adopted because it was going to be so expensive. So it was eventually adopted only after it got watered down a bit. But so they struggled with this, how best to do this, how best to ensure that all children get this education, which is so critical to the continuance of a free republic. It was a struggle, and they looked at different ways of meeting that goal.
Now, Phil, I want to go to you with this one. John Adams, referring to the Bible, said, quote, it was the best book in the world. Now, when we look at that quote as regarding to content of the education that our founders underwent, your comment?
Well, clearly the founding generation was exposed to that view and would feel quite comfortable with it. By comparison, on the other hand, we look at where we are today, and we're at the opposite end of that scale, I believe.
Well, and also, not only on top of the content, we see a comprehensive view of education, because not only do they focus on content being that of a biblical worldview, but they also call on the support thereof to be biblical even of itself, based on charity of citizens or even the charity or financial support of the government to continue the system of education which was already established. Phil,
I'm going to miss a response to that, because I guess I missed your point there.
Well, my point being that they saw that the structure of education was fine as it was, and we're going to have to end on this, but that the structure of education was fine as it was, and that all of the concepts overarching for education as a whole, their worldview on it was biblically based.
Absolutely, and we see
that in the financial support as well. Thank you so much for listening. We're going to have to call the broadcast today, but I'm Michael Evans. You've been listening to We the People, The Constitution Matters. Thank you so much for listening. Phil Duffy, Gary Porter, and Pastor David Whitney and myself all say thank you, and we will see you next week, Friday morning, 7 to 8 a.m., for We the People.
Hi, I'm Hans Tenbaum with Valley Forge PC Repair. I offer affordable and expert computer repair services. Deal with a locally owned business who cares more about their clients' needs. The services provided include virus removal, repair, cleanups, tune-ups, tutoring, consulting, and other computer services. Most services can be done at a flat rate. Senior citizens mentioned WFIL receive a 10% discount. Call me at 610-462-3210 for more information.
ShopRite of Hatfield is American-owned, locally operated grocer. We support veterans and seniors by giving 5% discounts. Just bring in your ID. Download the ShopRite mobile app to enjoy weekly savings, coupons, recipes, and so much more. ShopRite of Hatfield, 170 40-foot road, open 7 days a week, 7 a.m. to 11 p.m.
ShopRite, we're all about food, savings, and you.